Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang as part of our Thursday Live. And like we did the last week and the week before that, we will be continuing with conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, the discussion based on a book that has been authored by Dr. Hislop. And as Prem mentioned it last week, we don't see any need to bring up new themes or topics every alternate fortnight, because the variety that we find in these conversations is simply awesome and wonderful. So without further ado, let me welcome Brother Prem to the discussion to give us a brief summary of what happened last week, so that we can then go ahead with this week's discussion. And yes, before anything, as always, we offer our most humble and loving pranams at the lotus feet of beloved Bhagwan. Sairam Prem.
Sairam, dear listeners, and Sairam Arvind, and it's wonderful to be back here. And we were in the middle of a very beautiful discussion as we, towards the end, we had mentioned a variety of themes were being gone through in the course of that discussion, especially about God's forgiveness. I think that was the point where we had stopped. There was this talk about the use of different techniques of healing in the Sai centers. I think that was one thing. That's where it all started. Hislop asked about a healer who wanted to practice in the Sai center. And Swami's answer was simply put a no-nonsense answer. Mm-hmm. Swami said, why do you need energy from outside to heal you when you are God? You know, in reality, you are God. And you don't need any power from outside to heal any kind of ailment. Right? Swami's answer was so clear and so categorical. And that is when the attitude we must have towards suffering and pain was discussed. And Swami was talking about how grace comes when there is a certain amount of acceptance. Surrender is being neutral towards pain and suffering, Swami spoke of. And when there is that kind of surrender, there is nothing that Swami cannot do. Swami, the discussion kind of meandered towards cancer being, cases like cancer in the last stages. And Swami said it doesn't matter. You know, for God, there is no question of, is it the first or third stage of cancer or the most malignant cancer? It doesn't really matter. For Swami, I think that's what Swami is talking about. And in the course of that discussion, I think the question about sin and forgiveness for sin, does God forgive sins? I think that was where we had kind of stopped. And we'll continue the discussion from there.
You know, when Hislop asked Swami whether Swami can even heal cancer in its final stages, it reminds me of our human fallibility. We often make the mistake of considering God to be what we are and possibly a bit more. And therefore, we impress upon God the limitations that we experience in our bodily and mental functions. You know, for example, if I feel it's easy to get a cup of coffee but difficult to buy a home for myself, I also assume that if I pray to God for a cup of coffee, I'll get it easily. But praying for a home, it will require a lot more of effort and it will take time for God. That is the kind of, what can I say, at a subtle level, the mistake we do when we think of God to be like ourselves plus 10% or plus 20% or plus 30%. What we have to remember is when that will is there, in an instant it happens. It doesn't matter whether it's a small bruise or whether it's the final stage of cancer. If the will is there, the final stage of cancer is gone in a trice. I think an episode like that, not of cancer actually, but of a healing in a trice, we will possibly see in today's discussion. But if the will is not there, then even a small injury, a graze on the leg, can go on for a longer time or a much greater extent. So that is one thing we have to be wary of, be careful of, not forget who Swami is. Going ahead, Hislop asks, can it be correct that God forgives sin? And Swami replies, with sincere repentance, all sin can be washed away. God's grace responds, if it is His wish to forgive, nothing can stand in the way. All karma is cancelled out. At the root of all spiritual action, which is without reaction, is the seed of love. If the seed is nourished, it will grow as the tree grows, and all things of value automatically come from the tree of love. Regardless of the sins of the past, if there is a deep repentance and love for God, the sins are washed out and the nature purified. To fear otherwise is weakness. God has infinite compassion. Seek His love and forgiveness follows. So Swami makes it very, very clear that if God wishes to forgive, then nothing can stand in the way. It doesn't depend whether you have a bushel of karma or a mountain load of karma. It'll all be wiped out clean. It's about winning the grace of God. Because Swami says, at the root of all spiritual action is the seed of love. And Swami also makes it very clear here that spiritual action is that which has no reaction. So it is the seed of love which is the basis for all spiritual action. And when that love is invoked, just like Swami says, there is no reaction. Even the past reactions can just get nullified.
I think what needs to be remembered, and I think we must have spoken about this before also, when you look at the karma theory, you know, I know you talk about sin and merit, you're referring to the karma theory of you doing something wrong and being punished for it, you doing something right and being rewarded for it. And Swami has said categorically, it's like a foolproof system. There is no way that you can do something wrong and get away with it. Mm. You will have to face the consequence. At the same time, the good that you do will be rewarded. You know, there might be no one seeing, it might appear like no one's appreciating, no one is acknowledging what you're doing, but that reward will come. Swami says it's an infallible system. But we should not forget the purpose behind the system. The whole idea behind the system is that learning process that is meant to happen within us. I was just going through another discourse where Swami speaks about punishment. There's another point where Swami speaks about punishment. I was looking for that discourse, and that's how I read this other discourse. Swami would often say that here, though he says that you should not, there is nothing that cannot be forgiven by God. Swami would also say that you should not seek forgiveness from God. Hmm. If you've done a mistake, you should be bold enough to face it. You should never tell God that, you know, I've done this mistake. Please take away the consequence from me. You should only pray for strength. So though Swami says that God can forgive all mistakes, and He does do that when He wills, Swami would say that you should not seek that. The reason why you should not seek that, Swami says, is because you've done a mistake and there is no better way to atone for it than to accept the consequences and the responsibility to, you know, live through that. So in that sense, Swami was saying that, and it's an important point that often comes up when we talk about the karma theory. Swami says, let's say that there's a person who has committed a murder. The police will go after him, they'll catch him, and either they will give him capital punishment or they'll give him life imprisonment. So Swami says this man has committed murder because there was something wrong with his intention or something, the emotions were wrong and it was driven by that. But you're punishing the body, right? So Swami says, but that's all the government can do. There is no other way the government can punish you. It can only punish the body, hoping that the punishment to the body will make you repent, right? But Swami says, but God's working is not like that. And that's one of the reasons why you might feel that, you know, somebody physically gets away with something that they've done. Someone who has cheated seems to be living a rich life. Somebody who has committed a sin seems to be getting away with it, which means physically they're getting away with it. Swami has other ways of mentally making them go through whatever they had to go through and come out of it. And as Swami is saying here, the whole idea is so that you learn from the mistake. And eventually everything is love. So when Swami says, when that has been learned, that lesson has been learned, probably to go through that punishment or through that repentance may be unnecessary because the lesson has been learned. So from that point of view, I think Swami would say that don't seek for forgiveness. But that doesn't mean that God cannot forgive. So don't think in your mind that it is beyond God. It is even beyond God's grace. But at the same time, take responsibility for it. And once you've learnt what has to be learnt, it doesn't matter. As we'll go forward, Swami will say how Swami kind of negates the effect of that bad consequence also.
There's a very important point you made about punishment not being just physical. Now, you know, we think that if somebody has robbed someone of, say, $1 million, there should come a time in life where he should be made to face poverty. we think, because of our limited understanding, we think that is the just punishment. That is why even our courts and our legal system is designed in such a manner that the punishment given is similar to the kind of crime.
Right.
The more terrible the crime is, the more terrible the punishment is. Again, as you rightly said, the courts and the governments can do only physically. Just day before yesterday, there was an elderly uncle with whom we were having a discussion. The discussion got quite heated because he felt that the world is a very unjust place. He said, for example, we know that the Kauravas, you know, he said that you seem to be specializing in knowledge of our culture and all that. Okay, let me bring an Indian cultural example. He said, take the Mahabharata. Yes, the Pandavas won the war finally. But so what? They didn't rule for long enough. But Duryodhana, on the other hand, he died in an instant. So his suffering was just for 18 days. Even if you think that he suffered throughout the war, he suffered for 18 days. But before that, he ruled the kingdom for so many years. I don't mind a life like that of Duryodhana, because you can do all the bad you want, enjoy everything, and suffer for 18 days. That is where, you know, I think understanding, a deeper understanding of the itihasas and being exposed to Swami's discourses and teachings makes all the difference, because when we examine, we realize that in truth, in reality, Duryodhana was not having a good time. That is the reason why, though he had the entire kingdom for himself, he still wasn't ready to hand over 5 villages to the Pandavas. Because he saw that even without the 5 villages, the Pandavas seemed to be much more happier, more peaceful, more contented than him. And he was very jealous of them. That is why, though they were in the forest without anything, he devised multiple stratagems so that people can go and trouble them. Because in the heart of his heart, he wanted to see the Pandavas cry out and say that, oh God, we are suffering. But that never happened, and though he had everything, he didn't seem to have any joy, happiness or peace of mind. So like you said, the body might seem to be enjoying everything, but as Swami would say in the discourse, money can buy you the most royal bed, but can it buy you a good night's sleep? Some nights when I find it difficult to sleep, I always think of, you know, a couple of these homeless people that I saw on the hard pavement without anything, with all the traffic going around and the dogs around. Yes, it looks like a pitiable sight, but viewed in another way, they are sleeping peacefully. We don't know. They are having deficiencies, but we are nobody to judge and say that I am more happy than them. Looking at them, we learn the lessons of gratitude and other such things, but no way to judge that I am happier than them. In the same way, I think we are no way qualified to see how somebody is happy or how somebody is not, because of which our judgment on the karma theory being partial or ineffective is not proper. In the same manner, you know, when we say that we are not able to judge somebody's happiness or peace, in the same way we are not able to judge somebody's repentance. I'm saying this because sometimes we think, you know, he did this wrong thing, I also did the wrong thing, he felt sorry, I felt sorry, but Swami responded to him, but Swami ignored me when Swami was physically around. Even when Swami is physically not around, we just feel that somebody has done the same mistake and both of us have felt equally bad, but he seems to have gotten away with it, but I am stuck. Because the sincerity of repentance is something that can be judged only by God. Though I can say that he repented, I repented, I am judging it based on what I am saying, but what is the sincerity of repentance, what has actually happened, what is the transformation that has happened inside, that only God can judge. And that's why only Swami can decide whether, you know, somebody needs to be totally freed from the karmic implications, or somebody needs a partial freeing, or somebody needs to go through. It is our faith in Swami that we should hold firm and realize that whether I am going through my karma, partially going through it, or I am being absolved of it totally, it is all his love and grace, and it is being done because that is the best possible thing for me. That is what surrender is, Swami says.
And like one of the devotees of Swami was once telling us, sometimes when you look back at your life, you know, when you've led a long life with Swami, when you look back, you will find that you've made many mistakes, and you are repenting those mistakes, you're sorry for those mistakes, but somewhere you feel that, you know, out of purpose Swami made you those mistakes. Because it's sometimes that repentance which makes you feel humble. It's that repentance which makes you feel a little more cautious about your future steps. So sometimes you will find that, you know, that a few mistakes here and there is important.
Help you grow.
Right. our former lecturer from the university, Dr. Sainath, used to tell. It's a very famous episode which he's narrated many times, even in Swami's presence, when those chandeliers for the hospital used to come and for Kulanthal used to come. Whenever Swami would go out for darshan, they would, you know, assemble all those chandeliers, and they would, I think they would have two poles which are tied across, and, you know, they would be hung suspended, from there, suspended from there. And Swami will have a look at it, and Swami will say, yeah, this is nice, and where it should be put, Swami would say. So like that, one consignment had come. So they were putting it together. I think they did not have enough time or something, and Swami had already come. So he decided to, you know, hold it up, and they will light up the chandelier, and Swami can see.
Oh, hold the chandelier in his hand.
Mm. And I think there was some wooden grip or some plastic grip, so he thought that there's not going to be any problem. So he was holding it up, and Swami looked at it, and Swami told him, you know, in my opinion, I think it's better you put some rod or something and suspend it from there. So they didn't want to delay Swami. I think this was before darshan or after darshan. They didn't want to delay Swami. He said, no, Swami, it's fine. I'm holding this part which probably will not give me a shock, and so it's fine. Then Swami hesitated for a moment, and Swami said, okay, if you think it's fine, it's fine. And the moment the power was turned on, and he said, he started dancing with the chandelier in his hand, and Swami had a hearty laugh. He almost fell off his chair laughing. And Swami said, see, I told you, that's why I told you, don't do it. He felt so silly after that. You know, here is Swami. You know, why do we always turn to Swami when we want to make a decision, when we have a dilemma? Because we know that he's the one person who's got the clarity of vision of the present and the future. And such a Swami is telling you that this is a better thing to do because that might happen. Then you should just keep quiet and listen to it. And here he was brushing aside a counsel coming from the wisest person, right? Not just any wise counsel. So he said he felt so silly, but you know, it left such a important lesson in his mind that never take any advice which is given casually by Swami simply, because nobody knows better, right? And that's what happens, you know. Nobody is infallible. Everybody makes mistakes. But sometimes when you make those mistakes, and if you're wise enough to always remember them, I think it'll keep you humble and it'll keep you very vigilant in your future endeavors.
The answer to the next question is very, very interesting. It gives so many insights. The question is, does God forgive even present karma? Because I think Hisla is asking this because in the previous answer, Swami makes references to sins that have been done, sins that have been committed. So he's asking that, is it possibly live? As I'm doing my present karma also, will God forgive? And Swami says, there are three types of karma, past, present and future. Present karma must continue. It is like the carriage behind which is a trail of dust. If the carriage stops, the dust will settle on it. A doubt might now be that the carriage cannot forever continue so as to be ahead of the dust it is raising. But the carriage need not always travel on a dusty road. It can get on to the surfaced highway where there is no dust. That highway is equivalent to the grace of God. There is a difference between the benefit of grace and the benefit of bhakti or devotion. A patient with a pain is given a sedative which dulls the pain. But grace is an operation that does entirely away with the pain. Make no mistake, grace does entirely away with karma. Like a medicine which was labeled good until 1968, if it is used in 1973, the medicine is entirely ineffective. The body is the bottle, the karma in the body is the medicine. God can put a date on the medicine so that it is not effective.
And this answer that Swami gives, I think, is we've spoken about it. One of the first few satsangs that we did was about the three types of karmas, and we had spoken of it. But it's difficult to clearly say what Swami is referring to as past, present, and future karma. You could say that the future karma, from the analogy that Swami would give about, you know, shooting an arrow, Swami would say that the arrow which has already been shot is the prarabdha karma, which is the karma that is ruling this particular lifetime. The arrow which is about to be shot, you know, you have loaded the bow and you are about to shoot it, Swami would say that is the agami karma. That even as you are doing everyday activity, you are creating karma for the future. And the bows which are there in the quiver.
Arrows in the quiver.
Right, I'm sorry, the arrows in the quiver, Swami would say, is the sanchita karma. if you look at it from that point of view, I think Swami is referring to Sanchita Karma as future karma and the present karma as Prarabdha.
Agami.
I think Prarabdha. Right? And I'm sorry, you're right. Present karma is Agami karma and the past as probably the Prarabdha karma. And the question is about the karma that we're creating even as we are doing actions. So Hislop is asking, will it be able to deal with the present karma too? You know, it kind of negates the mistakes that you've done in the past, but what happens to the karma that you're doing right now? The analogy which Swami gives is very, very beautiful, because one thing which Swami says is, yes, as long as you are doing, there will be karma. And Swami gives the example of riding a bus or riding a vehicle on a dusty road. But the beauty is, as Swami would say, the moment you start doing the present karma in a manner that you're doing it as an offering, doing it as, you know, Swami would say, as an instrument with love, without attachment to any of the fruits thereof, basically karma yoga. So Swami would say, when you're doing it like that, there is no karma which is going to attach to you. And Swami gives the beautiful analogy of riding a vehicle on a highway road. There is movement, there is action being performed, but there is no dust, because you have risen yourself to a different platform altogether.
In the beginning, when Swami says, at the root of all spiritual action, which is without reaction.
Right.
I think when we do karma phala tyaga, pavitra karma, or do everything as an offering to God, it no longer remains as an ordinary action, it becomes spiritual action. And Swami says spiritual action is without reaction. That is why, you know, they say that the sages and saints and people of men and women of God, they don't build any karma at all, because they are doing all their actions as per God's will without any expectation of reward or punishment. They have no desires of their own linked there. That's why there's no karma generated. So Swami says that till you reach that level, that is till you reach the highway, you have to constantly keep doing your sadhana.
Right.
You have to keep moving. You have to keep progressing. Because the moment you stop, the dust will come and settle on you. It will catch you. So you have to constantly, it's a daily, whether it's a daily, hourly, basically a regular sadhana schedule is required till we start running on the highway. And then Swami says, again, you know, after saying that what we do as sadhana, our devotional activities, Swami says that though it does not remove the pain, it does not wipe out the karma, it acts like what a painkiller does to pain. You are going through the pain, but you don't realize the pain because you have taken the painkiller. So, sadhana, bhakti, all this helps in that manner, wherein you go through the karma, but are not affected by the karmic effects. You are dulled to it. But Swami says, on the other hand, God's grace is like an operation that is done. It's a complete healing. It is a complete cure. It is totally removed and thrown out. So there is no more pain at all. So God's grace is complete. I'm thinking it's more like the shower of rain that comes when you're on the highway. Once it's cleaned and then there's no more dust that is rising. That kind it is. So Swami makes it very, very clear that karma effects can be dulled through devotion and sadhana. But when you win God's grace, God's love, it totally wipes it out. And that's why I think, you know, Swami says there is no reason for love, no season for love. Nothing else, no question is asked, what is the size of the karma, how much karma, how bad is the karma, nothing. Once you win God's love, whole thing gets wiped out. In fact, it reminds me of the Christmas of 1998. In that discourse, Swami actually makes reference to this no reason for love, no season for love, and he actually introduces it. I think it would be very sweet to hear it in his divine voice before continuing the discussion.
స్వామి యొక్క తత్వము,
స్వామి స్నేహ,
నా యొక్క పవిత్రత ఎవ్వరు కూడా అనుభవించలేరు, తెలుసుకోలేరు.
భగవాన్స్ డివినిటీ అండ్ ద సాంక్టిటీ నోబడీ కెన్ నో ఇన్ ఫుల్.
ఫస్ట్ క్రిస్మస్ ఇక్కడ జరిగినప్పుడు నేను ఒక చిన్న పాట పాడినాను.
ఆన్ ది డే ఆఫ్ ది ఫస్ట్ క్రిస్మస్ సెలబ్రేషన్ హియర్ స్వామి sang a song
20 years back. Love is my form, truth is my breath, this is my food. My life is my message, expansion is my life. My life is my message,
expansion is my life.
No reason for love, no reason for love, no but, no hope. Love is my form, truth is my breath, this is my form.
Love is my form, truth is my breath, this is my form.
Sai Baba Samachar, my friend, Chapanakuti, ye part to me, Mugin Chandi, and tennis, while Abdan Cheskoga.
Sai message can be conveyed like this by singing this song, they can understand.
Love is his bomb.
Love is his bomb.
And the question in chapter, my life is my message.
So Bhagavan says, my life is my message.
Kaluka, mirandar kudanu, prapanchamulo andar to kudanu, sodar sodatva ani penchukoni.
Develop the feelings of fraternity.
Brotherhood of man, fatherhood of God. Ee rendintini meer drudham chesukondi.
The brotherhood of man and fatherhood of God. Strengthen these two ideas.
So that's Swami speaking about very beautifully saying that if anybody asks you about who is Sai Baba, this is the best answer that you can give. Tell them that Swami is, love is his form and truth is his name, bliss is his food. The main portion that Swami is speaking about here, or the main theme that Swami is putting across here in this, is that you know, when you make a prayer, or when you're trying to invoke Swami's presence in your life, invoke Swami's grace in your life, it is very important to remember this, that Swami is love, and whatever comes from Swami or whatever can be solicited from Swami, it is only through love, and there is no limit to that love, and every limit is only in our mind. You know, it is we who think that, oh no, this is a cancer, can we ask Swami? No, this is this is not an admission in a normal college, this is in an Ivy League college, you know, will Swami's grace work? I think all that is only in our mind. When you pray, I think it has to be completely remembered that Swami's grace is beyond all of that. And especially when you do mistakes and when you're repenting, I think it's a very important thing to remember that Swami's love is so immense that there is actually no sin that Swami will not overlook in that sense. But the whole idea is that we learn from that. You know, as a teacher who is going to give you grace marks and make you pass is not necessarily the most loving teacher. The teacher who ensures that you learn the lesson and you go to the next grade wiser, I think that is the truly loving teacher. In that sense, Swami's love is absolute. So as Swami was saying even the last week, you know, even that punishment or even that kind of strictness and rudeness is nothing but a form of blessing and nothing from a form of grace. So I think it is important to remember that. And so very beautifully Swami says, you know, the slight difference between bhakti and grace. Bhakti is we trying to take our mind away from this mundane pain, right? And it needs a conscious effort. You need to remind yourself in the middle of your pain and say, after all, what is this? And Swami is there. But the grace that Swami is speaking about is, you know, through that bhakti, when you win that grace, the ability to feel pain is being removed from you. You no more feel that pain. You no more suffer that incident that happens in your life. If you have to think of a mundane example, it's probably, you know, the tonsil operation which is performed. Until the tonsil is there, and every time it gets inflamed, every now and then you have to take some medicines kind of which silences the pain for that point in time. But if the tonsil is removed completely, you do not have that, you don't suffer that anymore. So almost like that, when God's grace comes, the nature in us which makes us suffer something and makes us rejoice in something, that is removed, and we are in a state by which we are able to look at everything as a blessing. And that's what happens.
When you spoke of the tonsillitis operation, I was reminded of a similar kind, which is the appendicitis operation. But I think let me not jump the gun, because that beautiful episode is coming up ahead. Let's go in the order. At this point in time, when Swami is making it very clear that everything is possible through God's grace, Hislop gets a question which I feel is natural, and all of us too would be getting that same question, which is, but Swami, grace is such a rare prescription. It's not that everybody wins grace. Yes, grace can do everything, but it's like saying winning a jackpot can get you a lot of money, but only a few win a jackpot. That's why it's called a jackpot. But Swami's answer interestingly and surprisingly, is totally in contrast to what we generally think. Swami says, it might be thought that grace is difficult to secure. Such is not the case. Grace is the easiest thing to secure if the method is known and used. In the Gita, the method is given. As in driving a car, so confusing at first, but with practice, so easy to do all the necessary tasks at the same time and also carry on a conversation without strain. There is nothing that cannot be accomplished with practice. Even ants in a single file crossing a stone will leave a mark. Swami says, repeatedly doing this. I think when Swami says in Bhagavad Gita the method is given, this is my thinking that possibly Swami is referring to the line which says, Abhyasena tu kaunteya vairagyena cha grihyate. Meaning you will be able to attain this through repeated practice and detachment. In the previous section, there was reference to detachment, and here Swami is emphasizing on the power of practice. Swami says that ants crossing a stone in a single file repeatedly leave a mark on them. There is this quote, I think it was your email signature which said, you are what you repeatedly do. Something like that. Or somebody's, I remember somebody's email signature being that, you are what you repeatedly do, which is so true. There is a beautiful example again from the Mahabharata. Arjuna is considered as the greatest archer. And it is said that one night when he was eating his dinner, a gust of wind blew the lamp off. And Arjuna continued to eat because one can eat in the dark. And when he was doing that, it struck him. He wondered, how is it that I'm able to eat? How is it I know where to put my hand in the plate?
I think Bhima was continuing to eat. All the Pandavas stop. Bhima continues to eat. And then Arjuna asks, how are you able to eat in the dark? So he says, you know, you don't need eyes to eat. The desire to eat is there. The food is in front of me. And that is enough.
And I've had practice of eating so many years. So I'm able to eat and put it in my mouth.
Right. So he talks about that intensity and the practice.
And that thing inspires Arjuna. And it is said that that night, he goes out and starts practicing archery in the dark. Because he says that if I practice it long enough, just like Bhima is able to eat his food when it's dark, possibly I will be able to do archery in the dark. And Acharya Drona, who is his guru, comes to know of this. He's immensely pleased. He also blesses him, saying that Arjuna, you're going to become a kind of archer that the world has never known, nor will an archer like that be born in the future. That's what happens. All these examples just show us the power of persistence and practice. I have my own personal example. You know, it was, I think, possibly about 12 or 13 years ago. I just started writing descriptively. And 10 years hence, as recent as 2 months ago, there was somebody who came and asked, I also would like to become a writer. How do you become a writer? What did you do to become a writer? I said, you know what? The honest answer is I wrote. I just realized that without any kind of special training or course or anything, if you just write and write and write, do it repeatedly, you become a writer. If you read and read and read, you become a reader. If you play and play and play, you become a player. I think that is the power of practice. That is the power of repeated actions. What we do repeatedly, we become that.
Right. And it's interesting that Swami is talking about winning God's grace also as something that can be done with practice. The thing is, you know, winning God's grace is probably a concept. As we were saying, that Swami is differentiating even between having bhakti and receiving the grace. So which means winning God's grace is a concept, but there is a methodology to it. And one of the methodology that Swami is speaking about is that of Namasmarana here. And I think that is why the importance is given to the repetition or the practice. Because in that same answer, Swami goes on to say, the name, it is that will guard you and guide you throughout life. It is such a small thing, but to cross the ocean, an immense steamship is not needed. Even a small raft will do. The name of God is the smallest of the small and the largest of the large. The mouth is the principal gateway of the body, and the tongue must always carry the name. Like a small lantern, the name must glow when and where you go. Go when and where you go. And then you can travel easily through the whole forest of life. So here, if you look at the act of earning Swami's grace, or the point of earning Swami's grace as the goal, Swami is saying that there is a methodology to it. You invoke Swami through his name, through the thoughts, and those thoughts can be invoked through the name, and that can be made a practice, right? Because to practice something, you need something practical. You know, it has to be something that can be done, that can be performed.
Mm.
You know, how else do you practice winning God's grace? So Swami is so beautifully breaking it down to saying that start by chanting the name, make chanting of the name a practice, and that practice will make you earn the love towards God, and when you have love towards the God, eventually you will earn the grace.
And as I have said repeatedly, Prem, it's been my own personal experience that Namasmarana is so powerful. You know, at times when I seem to be at my wit's end, when I'm feeling very sad, when I feel that things are not going properly, there are many such moments all of us go through at different points of time in our life. When I feel that my intelligence has exhausted, I have tried all solutions possible, nothing seems to be working, basically it's a hopeless situation. Somehow, you know, it has been Swami's inspiration that I simply start chanting the Sai Gayatri. That is my favorite chant. Of course, each person has his own name, his own mantra, his own thing. And you won't believe it, Prem, within two, three hours, I start feeling better. It's magical and it works each and every time. Though the way the problem resolves itself or doesn't resolve itself may vary depending on situation, 100% guaranteed that within hours of continuously chanting and thinking of Swami, you start feeling so much better. You feel so much strengthened. You feel so much light. You feel so much more positive. That's why every time it happens, I wonder, oh my God, why don't I do this always? That is, I think, the challenge for us, because when things are going right and happy, we rarely think of Swami, we rarely chant his name. And we start chanting it every time we are in trouble. And every time we are in trouble, when we start chanting it, it comes to our rescue and we start feeling better. Again, once we start feeling better, we jettison it. I think that is a mistake we should avoid. I remember reading a story in that famous book series called Chicken Soup for the Soul. There was this boy who says that my father used to take me out for a ride in the horse carriage. The old story it is.
Mm-hmm.
So when he used to go out, he would say that I would be sitting on my father's lap and feeling the breeze in my hair and seeing the sights all around. It would be so much fun till I would tell my father that let me try to take hold of the reins and control the horse. My father would give the reins into my hand, but then once the reins are in my hand, the horse would tug and all my focus would be on controlling the horse. The reins would cut into my palms. I would feel pain and I would cry out and tell dad, take back the reins. And then the dad will take back the reins and again I could sit and enjoy the journey. So this is what happens to us in our life. We think that we can take charge of our life. We can do things in our life. And when we do that, our focus becomes so much entirely on that we fail to observe the beautiful things in life and we suffer with pain. That is when we surrender and tell Swami take over. We do Namasmarana. We do all this. Swami takes over and we are again back to enjoying the scenery, enjoying life and trusting God. But the problem is, maybe after the wounds on the hand heal, we again feel that, hey, maybe it'll be fun to take the reins. Let me take the reins back in the hand. I think this is something that we should constantly guard ourselves against.
And also, I think it's an indication to especially parents and teachers who are trying to train children in their life and prepare them for life. I think this is a very, very important point that Swami is making, that there are different ways, even if you look at Swami's educational institutions, in which you can make taking Swami's name a practice.
Hmm.
You know, you wake up in the morning, there's a prayer session. Before you eat your food, there's a prayer session. Before you start studying, there's a prayer session. Before there's a meeting, you chant Swami's name. You know, these are all events in your life which will keep repeating. Can you attach that to the chanting of a name or a mantra or doing any Namasmarana? Similarly, in the individual level, if we can attach every certain emotion to Swami's chanting of Swami's name, just like you said, when you're scared of something, you start chanting Swami's name. There was a very beautiful article that somebody had shared sometime back. I think it was part of one of the newsletters of the organization in the United States or something like that, where a lady says that, you know, a lady devotee had written about this. She said how we have made this a part of our life. Right? We gasp taking Swami's name. You know, we express joy taking Swami's name. We are scared we take Swami's name. You know, somebody that you find a bad driver on the road, you take Swami's name. Right? And suppose you've missed something, you're looking for your keys, you've lost it, you say Sai Ram. So in a way, you know, it is not something that we can take credit for. In a way, Swami has made us do this. And I think if we have to pass on something which Swami has given us to our future generation, I think this should be that. In what, in how many ways can we make taking Swami's name a habit in their life through all of these practices? I think that's a very important point that Swami is saying here. Because one thing which we tend to think, and I've heard this from a lot of youngsters, and I think even we would have felt it at some point in our life, that it becomes very mechanical and we probably don't think of Swami when we're taking Swami's name. I think it really doesn't matter. You know, the power of Swami's name, that's why Swami is saying it's like a lamp. Sometimes you might even forget that you have a lamp in your hand, right? But the lamp will not stop doing its work. To a great extent, the lamp will continue to shed light. And I think Swami's name is like that. Yes, it is best if we are able to lose ourselves in that emotion of devotion when we're taking Swami's name. That would probably be the best. But taking Swami's name is any day better than
not taking
completely
it.
Forgetting it and not taking it.
On that note, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break. And on the other side of the break, we will continue because there's a change in the theme. And we are coming to that appendicitis that I had referred to a little time earlier. All that after the break, so don't go away anywhere.
ज्योति तुम हो साई
जीवन ज्योति तुम हो साई
जीवन ज्योति तुम हो साई
जीवन ज्योति तुम हो साई
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साई प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ सारी प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साईं प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ जीवन के इन अंधियारों में साई दीप जलाओ
जीवन के इन अंधियारों में साई दीप जलाओ
जीवन के इन अंधियारों जलाओ
जीवन के इन अंधियारों में साई दीप जलाओ
साई दीप जलाओ सत्य ज्योत जलाओ साईं प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साईं प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
ज्योत जलाओ साईं प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साईं प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
जीवन ज्योति तुम हो साईं
जीवन ज्योति तुम हो साईं
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साईं प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साईं प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
जीवन के इन अंधियारों में साईं दीप जलाओ
जीवन के इन अंधियारों में साईं दीप जलाओ
साईं दीप जलाओ सत्य साईं दीप जलाओ ज्योत जलाओ साईं प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साईं प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साईं प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ साईं प्रेम की ज्योत जलाओ
जीवन ज्योति तुम हो साईं
Welcome back, dear listeners. We just took a break, and before that, we were talking about Swami says the practice of Namasmarana. And Swami says, just like how everything in life is all about practice, Swami would say, talking is practice, walking is practice, and everything we've learnt is through very, very general practice. And this is something which is so easily forgotten. For all the trivial things in life, we are ready to be patient, we are ready to put in the practice. But when it comes to God's grace, when it comes to spiritual development, to spiritual progress, we become impatient and say, how much more we should do? Or, you know, I've been doing it for so many years. Here is something that is going to benefit you over many, many lifetimes, but we want it in a trice. But a simple BSc degree, an MSc degree, we are ready to work three years for that. And for that 3 years, 12 years of schooling to get there, we have no complaints about that. For after all, a piece of paper which is going to give you a few thousands a month. But something as great as God's grace, as Swami is saying, that it doesn't matter how many mounds of sins that you have, it can all be burnt down by God's grace. To earn such a God's grace, we are asking, so how many years should I do Namasmarana, or how many years should I do Seva? I think that acknowledgement that this is something that you're chasing is so very precious will automatically give you that focus, that patience, and that perseverance, I guess.
Going ahead to the next question, it makes it very clear that this conversation is possibly happening in 1970, because the way Hislop asks about this episode is as if it's very, very fresh in his mind. So possibly 1971, because Hislop says, Baba's dramatic recovery from what the doctors considered as sure death during the Goa incident must have amazed and puzzled the doctors. And Swami gives an insider, a complete insider view, because he is the one who went through that, of what happened. But I just feel, Prem, before reading Swami's answer, because Swami has given details which are otherwise not available, I'll just quickly go through what actually happened. It was the 6th of December 1970 when Swami started off in a car to Goa Mm-hmm. And on the way to Goa, on the 7th of December, Swami spent some time at the bungalow of Dr. Adke, who was a very staunch devotee, and at that point in time, he was also the vice chancellor of the Karnataka University. So there, when Swami spent time, he met with all the deans of the university. He blessed the devotee, of course. But Swami complained of a kind of stomach ache, because of which he didn't take any dinner. And when they were traveling from there, now this is Dharwad. Dharwad comes on the way. It's still in the state of Karnataka. So they had to still travel some more before reaching Goa. During the journey, Swami also asked the driver to drive a little slow over the humps and bumps, because he was having stomach ache. Everyone who were with Swami, there was a group of devotees, including Professor Kasturi, who were there in Swami's entourage. They were all worried as to what was happening to Swami. At the border between the two states, Karnataka and Goa, I think Nakul Sen, who was the lieutenant governor of Goa at that point in time, mm-hmm. Swami was going to stay at his home. He had been blessed to be the host for Bhagwan. He was there to receive Swami at the Goa border, and from there it was the governor's convoy, you know, the royal convoy that went to the, it's called the Cabo Raj Bhavan. The Cabo Raj Bhavan, the governor's residence. And Swami again retired in the night without taking anything. He said, I don't want anything. The governor, lieutenant governor, I mean Nakul Sen, he was very worried. So the next day morning, when again Swami didn't take any breakfast, I think Swami just took some hot beverage a little bit, and he said, I don't want anything, and complained of stomach ache. He summoned the best of doctors. And like they say, too many cooks spoil the broth. What happened was, so many doctors gathered there, I think about 12 to 15 doctors, and they're all experts in their fields, and they started diagnosing Swami, and they came up with multiple diagnoses. And there was a kind of debate among themselves as to what could be the problem. And all through this, Swami was just smiling. And finally, it so happened that Swami selected the diagnosis which was right. Swami said that it was a case of appendicitis. So the doctors concluded that it was paracolic appendicitis, and it needed to be operated upon immediately. Swami agreed that it was paracolic appendicitis, but he said that there is no need for any operation. And he left it at that. He called Professor Kasturi, and he told him to announce to the devotees that there would be no darshan or bhajan sessions. Swami would not be granting any public appearances for the next couple of days. But on the 10th of December, Swami will grant darshan. So Swami not only told him to cancel the darshan session, Swami also gave him the time and date when Swami would be granting darshan. The evening of the 10th of December. So the 8th and 9th of December, Swami was in great pain, and the doctors were fervently praying, those who were devoted. Most of them were not devotees, so they were warning the lieutenant governor of dire consequences that Swami would face if he didn't agree for the operation. But then, as promised, Swami was there to grant darshan, and there was a bhajan session. Swami even gave a discourse on the 10th of December. And anyone who saw Swami then there in Goa knew for sure that Swami is not suffering anything at all. So that was a miracle that happened, that has been recorded by Professor Kasturi and many others as well. But what is unique is, I think, this perspective that Swami gives of what happened.
Right. In that reply, Swami says, the next morning after Baba had at 4 p.m., we'll just go back to that question. So Hislop says Baba's dramatic recovery from the doctors, what the doctors considered as sure death during the Goa incident, must have amazed and puzzled the doctors. And Swami responds to that saying, the next morning after Baba had at 4 p.m. walked down the 150 steps from the palace to the platform from which he delivered a spiritual discourse. There was a conference of the 25 doctors who had been called by the governor to consult over Baba, along with quite a number of their medical students. The argument was, how could a body with ruptured appendix and without operation continue to live? The top doctor said, we are in a useless discussion. Sri Satya Sai is divine. Swami says, that Baba created 25 rings all at once, one for each doctor. They have now all surrendered to Baba and they call Sai Ram before treating any patient. The radio reported Baba is dying. The best doctors in India were called in, but Baba was black in color. The doctors gave him varying times of up to maximum of 10 minutes or so to live. Baba then declared that he would lecture in the afternoon and that he had taken on the illness of a devotee. India's most prominent doctors said, "That may be so, but I say you are about to die." Baba said, "See at 4 p.m.
It's amazing to sit and read that, because it's amazing. On the 10th evening, Swami gives darshan and there is bhajan, and Swami gives a discourse, lecture that Swami calls. He gives a discourse and these doctors are stunned. Their jaw must have dropped and hit the ground and gone underground as well in awe. And the next day, on the 11th, the first thing that Swami does is, as Swami said, calls all the doctors and gives them presents and gifts, including the rings that Swami manifested in one shot. As a token of his gratitude towards them. You know, this is amazing. How funny the doctors might have felt. Here is a patient expressing gratitude for something that we never did. You know, we didn't touch him. And I think our best contribution was that we didn't touch him. Because the way Swami came out of that appendicitis is amazing. And after that, there were no signs of it at all. Throughout the trip, throughout that year, throughout, I think, Swami's physical surgeon on earth. Because Swami stayed in Goa from the 11th, The 11th morning was when Swami gave an interview to all these doctors, till the 21st. And on 21st, Swami flew to Mumbai. And there was a hectic schedule there. So it was all done in an instant. And I think this is how God's grace works. You know, God's grace, if something has been decided, it just happens. So Swami had taken over the appendicitis of a devotee to bless that devotee. And once that was done, seeing the way Swami recovered, one can understand the comfort and joy that the devotee must have felt. I don't know whether the devotee even knows, because I don't remember whether it was with his appendicitis or with the paralytic stroke that Swami took over. Professor Kasturi actually asks Swami, who is that person whom you took over? Swami says that is not important. And Kasturi muses later on that, look at this, God's love is so selfless that the person who has been benefited by his grace may not even know that he has been benefited by the grace. You know, because, yes, I think it's with regard to the paralytic stroke. Because Professor Kasturi writes that some people asked whether, you know, that person will even get to know that Swami's grace was on him. And Swami's reply is, how will he get to know? It is not as if I have partially taken over. It is not as if there's a small paralytic stroke that he gets, but the major one I have taken over. When the heart attack or paralytic stroke is taken over, it is taken over in all entirety. And therefore, you know, Prem, I feel this is the example of absolute selflessness. Where you suffer on somebody else's behalf and you take it over. And I feel even if we manage to do some kind of sacrifice like that, we definitely would let the other person know that it has been done to him or her. But here, there is no inclination towards that as well. So, to this day, we don't know who are these devotees who benefited with this immense shower of grace from Bhagwan.
And this is indeed one of the very important events in Swami's life. Swami would speak of this and the paralytic stroke. Maybe warrants a complete discussion on it sometime, just like how we did on the paralytic stroke and the Guru Purnima and the declaration of Shiva Shakti, which followed after that. Going back to the discussion here, after Hislop asks about that incident in Goa, he goes on to say, Swami, is it true that you suffered some extreme abuse from doctors when you were a small boy? And Swami responds to that by saying, Baba underwent torture at the hands of the village doctors when he first allowed his divine powers to manifest on a fairly large scale. This was around the age of 10. The doctors drilled holes in his head and stuck in hot irons, cut open his skin and poured in burning fluids, buried him in a trench with sand up to his neck, and used iron bars to keep him fixed in position. Here, he would just move and be free despite the iron bars. During all the torture, he smiled and felt no pain. He at no time had even the slightest body identification. When Baba was born, he knew his divinity and that he was God himself. The universe is held in Baba's hand, and he could in an instant make the entire universe vanish.
Now, there's nothing much to add to that description, which is quite graphic. I was just struck by this one point. This point was made by Kuppam Vijayamma as well. Kuppam Vijayamma Garu, when she was narrating, she said that when Swami first introduced himself to them, he said, the people call me Sai Baba. She emphasizes and says that he did not say I am Sai Baba. He said that they call me Sai Baba. And here also when you see, Swami, when Hislop is saying, is it true that you underwent this? Swami does not say, yes, I underwent this. Swami refers to himself as a third person. Always in third person. Like you would refer to something that is not you. And I think in Swami's case, that is born because Swami is rooted in that truth, which is that I am not the body. Just like I would say that, yes, this rod went, this rod went through this treatment. This rod was put in the fire and it got burnt. In the same way, Swami is speaking about his body like that. Yes, Baba underwent torture, Baba underwent this. He is referring to himself in third person, and that has been a characteristic right from the early days till whatever, you know, till as long as the physical body was there. Swami always referred to his body as separate from him. Because I remember once in Thrai Brindavan, I think it was Professor Jayalakshmi Gopinath, Jayamma. I don't remember exactly the details, but she said something like, Swami, I am 2 years younger to you or 2 years older to you, something like that. And instantly, you know, without even batting an eyelid, Swami's response was, 2 years younger than this body, you know. He always made it very clear. He was always, Swami is always in that truth that I am not the body. And I think it is because of that alone that he was able to come through all this torture. Otherwise, you know, any of us with half this torture, I think we would have collapsed and possibly died as well. But nothing happened because of that clear identification, I am not the body. You doing anything to the body is like you doing anything to this iron rod or that pot. It is not me and I don't suffer.
And very clearly Swami says, you know, when Baba was born, he knew his divinity and that he was God himself. This is not like, you know, proving a point to someone, or not like saying that, you know, I'm going to show you that I'm God. And Swami is saying that this was my nature. The universe is held in Baba's hand and he could in an instant make the entire universe vanish. So which means nothing that was done could have been, could do anything to Swami, and Swami could have done away with all of that in a moment if he did not want it. One was suggesting that the whole thing was willed and the whole thing had to be played out in front of all of us. But again, you know, all through this you can make out that Swami is reiterating again and again that don't forget who Swami is. And that becomes a very important thing to maintain in our minds, especially when we are praying.
Then Hislop, in continuation with what Swami said, prods him on and he says, Swami, please say some things about the early childhood. And then Swami gives a lengthy reply, and it's just a beautiful description of his childhood. There may not be much that we will add as commentary, but what Swami says is, Swami had 2 shirts and pants to last a year. There was no money even for a pin. Thorns were used to hold torn places together. Tears in the cloth came from schoolmates who would punish Baba for always knowing the answers at school. Only he would know the answer. If he gave the answers, the boys would beat him. If he did not give it, the teacher would beat him. On some occasions, the pupil who answered had to slap the faces of those who did not. Since Swami was small, he had to stand on the chair to slap the other pupils who had not answered the teacher. But he would slap gently. Then, the teacher would come and slap him hard as many times as a punishment for him having slapped gently. Of course, after the immediate retaliation on the boys, they would be loving and affectionate to Baba. Even though Baba had not even a pin for himself, he would procure pens, pencils, notebook, paper, or whatever the boys needed. This, at length, led to some fear in the village, because how could it be explained to the authorities as to how these things were present? At one stage, after the age of 11, Baba was kept more or less out of circulation for a couple of years. At that time, the liberation of India was in process. The police were moving in the villages and arresting Congress members and so on. And Hislop says, these early stories are extraordinary. They do not conform to anything we could imagine. Those childhood companions, they must have been quite special. Was their further destiny unusual also? And Swami replies, in the school there were two boys who sat with Swami in the same seat. I think today we know them as Ramesh and Paresh, or Ramesh and Suresh. When Swami declared that he would no longer go to school, one boy committed suicide. The other boy went mad. He would call Raju, Raju all the time. At length, he died. And Hislop says, it is very strange, a great mystery. But his death was a good death because his mind was fixed on Swami and constantly calling Swami's name, right? Swami says, yes, he merged with me. There was also a Telugu teacher, I think Manchi Raji Tamma Raju maybe, who took pains to get himself appointed to Swami's school and who left the school as soon as Swami left. So Swami reveals all this, and I think this is an appropriate time to tell our listeners that we have covered all these and much more of Swami's early childhood life, which has been revealed by Bhagwan and many other devotees who have been there with him during those years as part of a mammoth serial called Satya to Sai. The series is right now online on YouTube on the Radio Sai channel as a separate playlist as well. I think so far we have completed about 32 episodes, and the plan is within the next 1 month we'll be completing 36 episodes. And in these episodes we have covered Swami's life from his birth till the epochal letter that he wrote to his brother Sheshamaraju in 1947.
Right, and very, very fascinating to hear it again from Swami, and I'm sure his love would have been really awestruck by the whole thing. And I mean, even now, some of these things, the beauty of Satya to Sai for us, I don't know whether we can speak on behalf of the people who have watched it and listened to all these descriptions. We have read all of this in Satyam Shrim Sundaram, we might have read it in Swami's discourses. But sometimes that visual representation is so very important. In fact, a couple of months back, Bishu and I had the opportunity to go to Bukkapatnam. There's one particular temple which is on a hillock. Mm. And it was quite not a very difficult trek, but a decent trek.
The Venkateshwara temple.
Right, I think it's that Venkateshwara Balaji, temple. Huh. And the thing is, it is right now, if you want to go to that temple, you have to come all the way to Bukkapatnam and you have to take a slight detour from the village as such, and then go into the literally into the bushes and then climb into that temple. But apparently at that time when Swami was attending school in Bukkapatnam, it was something like a hill which Swami would climb up and climb down to reach the village. So it was like on the route from Swami's house in Puttaparthi to Bukkapatnam. And if you climb up that place and you look around, you'll find that it's so huge, the whole place, the hills which Swami would visit. The temple is in a different place. The school is in a different place. The amount of walking that Swami used to do just to get to school in Bukkapatnam as a little boy. And as Swami would say, it's not just coming to school and going back home in the evening. Swami would say, he would cook for the grandfather. He would run back in the afternoon to serve him the lunch and all of that. And it gives you that visual image of not only, it's not about Swami undergoing difficulty. I think it'll give you a different perspective of the difficulties that we undergo in life. When we are praying to Swami, when we say that, Swami, I don't have this, I don't have that, I need more money, or I need more this school or that luxury or whatever it is, it gives you a perspective of, when you know that this is the person whom you love and whose grace you are seeking and this is the life he has led, I think the way we look at our own life will be different. And that is why whatever Swami says about his childhood is so very precious.
And it actually shows us clearly why his life is his message. Because one thing is, anything that Swami gives advice to us, we can never turn and tell, easy for you to tell, you don't know what this means. If we look at it from a physical, worldly perspective, Swami has been disadvantaged in every way possible. And yet with all those disadvantages, without asking from anyone, without seeking from anyone, just by being what he is, he has become the avatar of the age. I think that is such a motivating thing for all of us, because to reach the ultimate state, one need not possess anything in the worldly sense. All you need to do is follow Swami's way of life. It's not even follow Swami's words. Just look at his life and follow it. See how he responded to criticism. See how he responded to difficult circumstances. See how he responded to very, very, very difficult people in the family. See how he responded to torture. See how he responded to loyalty. Just see all that, and I think even in part, if we imbibe that kind of a response in our lives, we will be able to experience in part the divinity that Swami is in our own lives.
Just a couple of days back, I was listening to a beautiful talk by Mrs. Gita Mohan Ram. You know, in that she says that, I think in a family interview that Swami was giving them, Swami was talking to her two little sons, and then Swami gave them a completely different 9-point code of conduct, or, you know, how do you lead a sacred life? And in that, Swami was saying that the first and most important thing is gratitude, right? So Swami was telling that, see, when you have gratitude, you'll know that whatever you are is because of whatever you've got from others. So automatically you will have humility, and if you have humility, you will have love. And like that, Swami gave, 9 points, and, she kind of noted it down and everything. And she had, I think, missed out a couple of points in between. Probably on some other day I'll get the details correctly. I'm just recalling it from memory. So she misses out a few points. And luckily for her, Swami calls them for an interview the next day also. And Swami finds that book in which he's making notes. And Swami said, you noted down what I told yesterday. And she took that opportunity and said, yes, Swami, I noted down, but a few points I missed out. So Swami asked, have you noted down all the other points? Then Swami, with a smile, Swami said, I know, you want to use it for a talk. And she said, yes, Swami, what you're saying is so precious. It has to be shared with everyone. And Swami said, yes, but don't tell it the way I told. Imagine Swami saying, don't tell it the way I told. So you should not tell gratitude and humility, and that will be very boring. You should tell a story for each thing. Right? And then Swami said, see, there are enough stories like this from Swami's life. So you can take stories for each one. And later there was another episode that Swami narrated, and Swami was saying that, many years later, there was an incident which happened, and Swami recalled that 9 points that Swami had given, and Swami said, this can be used for gratitude. Right? And then what Swami said was very, very sweet. Swami was saying, see, I don't need anything from anyone. Nobody needs to serve me. I don't, because I'm complete by myself. I don't need anything from anyone. But still I show gratitude. I still show gratitude to somebody who has served me for so many years. And Swami said, because I have gratitude, see, I'm always humble. And because I'm humble, I always speak lovingly. And because I speak lovingly, everybody loves me. The way Swami put it. So, as you said, everything is a lesson. There is no question of humility in Swami's life in that sense, because he is everything. There's no question of, him undergoing suffering as such. Because, by earning Swami's grace, if we lose the capacity to suffer, then where is suffering for him? Right? There is no question of him suffering. There is no question of him undergoing poverty. Nothing like that. But all of this is made so that it becomes a lesson for us. And that is why, dear listeners, please go and listen to or watch Satya Tusai. It is not a marketing of what we have done, because we feel so precious. We feel that it is such a precious thing that Swami has allowed us to go through.
Absolutely. And, just some time back we were discussing that sometimes when we do Namasmarana, keep chanting the name, we may feel that we are not actually feeling Swami's vibrance. We are just doing it monotonously. Even then, it has its benefit. But beautiful it would be when it has that feeling associated with it. Now, because it is the Bhagavatam, because it is the story of the Lord, and the variety and the beautiful way in which Swami's love concretized so that the devotees could benefit, it becomes so entertaining as well. Swami has made it so easy for us. We just need to listen to his stories, and it is not a sadhana. when you tell the word sadhana, you often associate it with some kind of a discipline, some kind of a rigor, some kind of, it's a task that has to be done. It is something possibly not so pleasant, but this becomes so pleasant. I myself go and watch and relive the stories, because for one, as I said, even if not anything else, it's such a nice, pleasant entertainment for the eyes, watching the beautiful form, never before seen pictures of Bhagwan. I had never seen Swami, you know, standing in waist deep water, swimming with all the others until this program came about. You know, so never before seen pictures, we get to see such beautiful songs and music pieces which Swami has composed. Swami has written these songs. When a devotee has come and asked Swami, how to ensure that you don't forget us, Swami says, sing this song. If you sing this song, how can I ever forget you? You know, Swami has given these compositions. So, when, by the blessings of Bhagwan, when a serial like this is made, wherein the songs are by Bhagwan, the stories are of Bhagwan, it is definitely entertaining, elevating, enthusing, energizing, you know, if I'm told to use only adjectives with E. It's so beautiful, and that's why, dear listeners, I would also like to, you know, give a plus one to Prem, as they would do in modern WhatsApp language, so that we go through this, and it's not just a one-time thing, like the Bhagavatam, we go through it again and again. I think we go through Sai Bhagavatam again and again, and that's one nice way to sanctify our lives, keep thinking of Him, reminding ourselves of His love. And after that, dear listeners, you know, the theme changes, because there's a visitor who is coming and asking Swami, is an exercise program important? Because in the West, exercise is considered to be of great value. Swami gives a very beautiful answer. Always, Swami, all of His answers are beautiful, but He brings in some points that we would not have otherwise thought of. But I think all that we'll have to wait for next week's episode, next week's satsang, because the time in our studios shows that we have just enough time for a song possibly. So we'll conclude with this song, dear listeners. And on the other side of it, you will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment Love to Love. As always, we offer this very humbly with all our love and gratitude at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
Satya Sai Mantra. Sadguru Sai.